This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.
A woman may read a Game of Thrones.
A woman may start a podcast.
Two women may host Podcasters Landing, the show devoted to the entire A Song of Ice and Fire series.
Two women may cover three chapters each week, followed by history and friendship lessons.
A listener may sit and tune in.
A woman may use adult language.
A woman may reveal spoilers.
A listener may support the show on our Patreon page at patreon.com/Sophia Mayer Studios, all under case.
A woman welcomes a listener to Podcaster's Landing.
Welcome to the show, everyone. This is the first ever episode of Podcaster's Landing, the podcast where two fantasy nerds reread A Song of Ice and Fire novels by George R.R. Martin. As mentioned in the show's intro, each week we are going to talk about three chapters, starting this week with the first chapter in the first installment of the series, Game of Thrones. We're going to be covering the prologue, Bran, and Catelyn. Then we'll move to a discussion of the parallels that we notice between the chapters read and their historical counterparts in British and or European history. Then we'll conclude with each host giving a friendship lesson inspired by the characters and or events within the designated chapters. But who is taking you on this magical journey? Please welcome my co-host, Natalia Ward, the Warden of the East, Lady Paramount across the pond. Nat, do you want to tell us, our listeners, a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. Very excited to be here and with Amy taking you on this journey. So I'm from originally from Brazil. I moved to the UK when I was 13. So it's been a very long time since I've been here. And I've been a fantasy nerd ever since I picked up my first Harry Potter book. And I've never let go. So I am all on board with, you know, Harry Potter, Game of Thrones, well, A Song of Ice and Fire, and consequently Game of Thrones, Hunger Games, etc. As you can imagine, there are too many to count. So by day, I'm a marketing officer for a recruitment company, and by night, I just nerd out reading and watching all sorts of fantasy and fiction. So yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Wonderful. And I am Amy Sophia Mayer. I was originally from Oregon, but traveled to the East Coast for college. I've studied abroad in Egypt, Turkey, Morocco, lots of places. So finally, I've come to settle in Indiana. I'm a university administrator by day and a writer and podcaster by night. I began podcasting in 2020 with my first show, Sublimely Gothic, which was devoted to classic and modern Gothic literature. I really enjoyed listening to the reread chapter by chapter format of other book podcasts, and I wanted to adopt that model for my own podcasting network. So here we are. Other important details about me include that I'm quite good at balancing things on my head. I prefer milk chocolate over dark chocolate, and I firmly believe that one day we will find a fossil of a dinosaur that could breathe fire, thus confirming the existence of dragons.
Absolutely.
So before we dive headfirst into the chapters, Nat, tell us about your experience with Song of Ice and Fire, being exposed to it, and likewise with the TV show, and just your overall relationship with this franchise.
So I guess I'm not Puritan Song of Ice and Fire reader. I only knew about it after the show was on for, I think, a couple of years. And everyone was telling me, oh, you should watch it, you should watch it. I tried to watch, you know, the first series once, the first episode, and I was like, oh, this is so boring. And then people just kept talking about it more and more. And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to read A Song of Ice and Fire, and then I will dive into the, you know, into the TV show, because when I read, I guess my imagination will just take me to all those places and I'll understand more about the realm instead of trying to guess what's going on in the TV show. So that's what I did. So I read A Game of Thrones, A Clash of Kings, and then as I was into A Clash of Kings, I decided I couldn't take it anymore and I really needed to visualize it. So I started watching the show, and then I was just kept up with it. But then, of course, they just drifted apart. So, you know, I do like my visuals, but I think the books are definitely a winner for me rather than the TV show.
Yeah, well, there are very few adaptations that meet it, or, you know, that exceed or at least meet, you know, the book standard. The only exception I'm thinking of is A Devil Wears Prada, because the movie is significantly more nuanced than its, like, just revenge story of the original novel.
Yes. I also, one of the examples of that as well is Gone Girl. I think that the movie adaptation was a lot better than the book, but that's just me. Really? But it was written by the same person.
Yeah. Again, there are certain stories that just, you know, do better as screenplays. But yeah, in regards, I am of a similar background with Song of Ice and Fire. I was 5 years old when the first book came out, so I certainly was not reading it back in the 90s. And of course, you know, Game of Thrones came out, and I was not a big fan. I don't even remember watching it myself. My mother was trying to watch it. And again, the first season, as you said, was a little boring. And then it just grew and grew and grew. And I knew it was this huge pop culture, you know, phenomenon. And so it got to a point where I think I didn't finally get into it until, like, there were 5 or 6 seasons already. And I just really love the actor Sean Bean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and even though I didn't know, like, the story, I'm just like, it's Sean Bean. He's going to die.
Absolutely. It's just a given.
He died in James Bond. He died in Lord of the Rings. He died in Medici. He like, there's only been like maybe 1 or 2 where he hasn't died.
That's his trope.
Yeah, like that there's a whole website, Stop Killing Sean Bean or something like that. So from that, I started, I already was an avid follower of another podcasting network, The Unspoiled, done by Natasha, and she started rereading Game of Thrones and doing the sort of, so I started to read the books along with her podcast, but I'm like, oh my god, these are so good, and so I binge read the rest of A Song of Ice and Fire. Way past, you know, because she's at this point still just on Clash of Kings.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So, yeah, and I was just really surprised at how much I enjoyed the writing style. And, like, for me, it's like Harry Potter was, you know, the big fantasy series of, like, my teens, of course. In my 20s, my favorite ultimate book series was A Cemetery of Forgotten Books. And then in my 30s, it's Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think Game of Thrones has really elevated the genre for me, because, you know, you start with Harry Potter and then you graduate to a few more serious ones. Well, serious in quotations, I guess, because, you know, Hunger Games is about killing a bunch of kids, and, you know, Maze Runner is also about killing a bunch of kids. So you kind of graduate from that and then you go into fully, you know, let's murder everyone at all times with Game of Thrones. I think that once you take the plunge with A Song of Ice and Fire, there's no going back, really. And I don't think I've ever gone back. Well, apart from Harry Potter, I think Harry Potter is a classic and it will always be. And it's my first fashion. In fact, that's how we met, right?
Of course, yeah. We met we are both listeners and patrons of the Fox and the Foxhound podcast, which is a Harry Potter podcast, which is done by a married couple, Amanda and Kevin Wilson. I strongly advise you all to check it out. And they have general discussions of the chapters they read, similar to our format. And then they have exercises of, the main one being, they do a marriage lesson from Harry Potter, which was the inspiration for the friendship lesson that we're going to do in this podcast.
Absolutely. So shout out to them for inspiring us.
Alrighty then. So shall we dive into the chapters themselves?
Yes, let's get into it.
So we're starting with the prologue. What were your thoughts revisiting the prologue?
Yeah, so looking into it's because it is my first time doing any sort of podcasting. So it is very curious looking at it with a critical eye, you know, trying to find more meaning into it, because before it's just mindless reading. But on this reread, I found that the prologue sets up very well how the rest of the series goes, even though there is a very small, quiet parts of the series. The underlying is this mysterious, creepy vibe that will just set everything off eventually. I think it was creepy. That's the word that of the moment for this chapter, because there's a lot of saying the branches stir gently in the wind, scratching at one another with wooden fingers, and a hoot of an owl, and the cold that just starts getting colder, right?
Yeah, I was thinking about that again, even in my first reading of the books earlier this year. I was really struck by, and I'm struck by it again, like, I feel like George R. R. Martin's writing style is such a delight, because it's a balance of being slightly poetic in that way, but not overdoing it. So it's not too flowery, but at the same time, it's not so basic that you have to, like, tolerate the prose to get to the story of the characters you like. It's a perfect balance of both, in my opinion. So, like, doing this podcast, you know, reread, it's like, oh, I gotta reread that again. And I was listening to the audiobook and I'm like, oh no, it's nice to listen to it again.
Yeah, for sure. It's the way that he writes, he really plays on your imagination. You know, like you said, it's not too flowery, but he does invoke emotions in you as you are reading, that makes you feel like you're really there. So, you know, when I was reading, the fact that they were really cold and it was starting to get colder when the others were coming in, I felt cold myself. So, yeah.
Of course. And what I just was making a note of, just the idea, and he will do this for the rest of the books, is his prologue is the point of character or point of view, or at least going visiting characters that are not main point of view characters. We just get the prologue of this one person to highlight a specific event, and then we never hear from that person again, which is not a new concept. A lot of stories, whether they're series or standalone novels, utilize the prologue of someone else's perspective to sort of paint a picture, and whether the rest of the novel's in flashback or whatever. So that's not uncommon. And then I also... Yes. Took note of a big chunk of Game of Thrones and the fantasy element, which, side note, in generally speaking, in the grand scheme of things, for an epic fantasy novel, the fantasy elements are quite low in Game of Thrones. Like, there's not, like, yes, so many witches and wizards running around like Harry Potter. But mm-hmm. one of the biggest components is the dragons. And it's interesting that, you know, he didn't choose to start with the dragons, or, like, maybe the dragon eggs being smuggled or whatever, like Aragorn mm-hmm. or something like that. He chooses the White Walkers.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think that he plays the fantasy element. He places them even very carefully throughout the book, so not to give fatigue, I guess, fantasy fatigue, because he is writing another audience. But mm-hmm. Yes, like you said, it is curious that he didn't start with that, but it is a slow burn, I feel. You know, even from, you know, when the dragons are hatched to when they mm-hmm. grow, it is a slow burn still. Mm-hmm. So it is, I guess, setting up this world where people just don't believe that there's anything magic going on anymore, which we're going to talk about later on in the chapter with the direwolves. Mm-hmm. So I think the way that he did that is just to be like, you know, oh, there's these creepy things that are going to start to happen, and then let's just finish with a bang on the dragons. Because, yeah, you know, shit's changing.
Yep. So in the prologue, we have three misfits, technically members of the Night's Watch, in the haunted mm-hmm. forest. Yeah. And I'm just thinking, because we know from, like, the Night's Watch is one of the more egalitarian entities, organizations, institutions that exist in this otherwise very hierarchical, medieval world. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, like, how, at least under the command of Mormont, who we know is, like, pretty, like, not too swayed by social standing or previous social standing for joining the Night Watch. Like, my biggest question and one of my notes is, why the hell are they indulging this 18-year-old?
I know, right? I thought there might be some sort of money involved, of course, as we see, I think is in Catelyn's chapter, that they are lacking in men for the Night's Watch. So I think it's giving them resources and money. And Sir Waymar, what's his surname? Sir Waymar Royce. Yeah, he comes from a very well-to-do family, very old family. So I think that has been, you know, that aspect is...
Yeah, you're right in the sense that it cannot strictly just be his social standing and nothing else, because again, Mormont really doesn't attach as much to that. The only thing that I could see Mormont, you know, allowing this little boy to have authority over a very experienced ranger like Garrod is if in him joining the Night's Watch, his family is providing tangible resources to the Night's Watch, which we know from later with Mormont's discussion with Tyrion that he's in desperate need of.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yeah, he's just, because of the house and because of his status, he's just very much cocky in himself. I think he puts up this farce that he is in charge. And I think people just humor him. But at the end of the day, he is some sort of 18-year-old. But, you know, it's all showing off. Like, for example, what he's wearing, you know, is saying he wore black leather boots, black woolen pants, black moleskin gloves, and a fine, supple coat of gleaming black ringmail over layers of black wool and black boiled leather. These are things that are very hard to come by, especially on the wall. And this guy is very much prepared, and he has like the tallest horse, and he has this sword, this long sword, bejeweled. I think it's all just a massive facade.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's described as this kid, Royce, is not in the same position as Samwell, who we'll meet later, of course, where it wasn't so much a sort of punishment or trying to get rid of him. It was getting rid of him, but at least to what we know, not with the same malice as it was towards Sam. And so I'm just thinking, like, we already know that the prestige of the Night's Watch has diminished significantly. So even though he's, like, not the eldest son, I'm just thinking there was really nothing better he could have done with his time and energy. And yeah, I was just really kind of, like, with no wars going on, like, technically there's peace under Robert right now.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just found that I'm just like, you can't go off and like do a tour in Essos and like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you'd never know if he's such a menace. There is a comment that I think it was Will that overheard, or if it was Garrod that overheard him saying it, because of his coat. Hang on, give me a second. I'll try and find it.
While you're reading that, I love this quote. "Dead is dead," he said. "We have no business with the dead." And that just reminded me of... It made me think of... I don't know. I was interpreting dead as, like, history. And the fact that, of course, we always were human beings. We're dumb and we ignore history. And history repeats itself. So it's like, yeah, it's dead. Yeah, dead is dead. But why did they die? That's an important detail.
Yeah, yeah. I just feel like the air that he gave, he just wasn't very interested in the situation, what was happening anyway, because it wasn't made very clear why they were beyond the wall. I guess just raids that they take up regularly, isn't it? But it just like just not very interested. And Garrett's saying we should get back soon because it's gonna get dark, and it's an nine hour ride back to the wall. And this guy is just like, oh, whatever. Does the dark unman you? Is
Yeah, it's a weird paradox in a way, mm-hmm. because at the same time, Royce is being, of course, as we discussed, very dismissive of everything. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he's also kind of applying some logic that, you know, they must have frozen to death. And Royce is just like, no, the water hasn't frozen. It hasn't gotten to a point where they would have frozen. Mm-hmm. So he is applying some logic and some curiosity. He's not applying that curiosity with Garrett's experienced wariness.
Yeah. Yeah. He's, I feel like he's trying to play devil's advocate on this, you know.
For the sake of being difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Just because, you know, he's just trying to be, like I said, a menace. It just, I guess it, like, you give too much power to an 18-year-old, what you expect, right?
Yeah, like, unless that person is a lawyer as their, like, job, I don't tolerate that in anyone else in my life.
Same here. It's just, like, just shut up. Yeah, so there's the quote that I was looking for. It says, his coat was his crowning glory, sable thick and black and soft as sin. And then Garrett says, bet he killed them all himself, he did, twisted their little heads off, our mighty warrior. So he might have been just a horribly nasty person. And, you know, the Royce family was just like, let's just send him to the wall and, get him out of our hair.
Oh, yeah, like a Ramsay Bolton that they knew. And it's just like, this is very true.
Yeah.
Again, in this world of balancing, like, maybe even if you want to technically punish or get rid of someone in your family, and even if individually they deserve it, still mm-hmm. they're a member of your family, and what they're doing in the world and where they are in the world reflects on the family. So they, again, even though they maybe mm-hmm. don't really like him, they still give him all these resources so that he's yeah. taken care of, and so he, you know, doesn't put up too much of a fuss at the Night's Watch.
Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, as I think this is what Cersei should have done with Joffrey in the first place. But I guess rules don't apply to the Lannisters or the royal family, I guess.
Yeah. Like, if I'm a tyrant, like, I want to go the Saudi Arabian route where just subsidize everything and make people comfortable so they don't rebel. Like, not... Mm-hmm. Not suppress them to the point of, like, absolute misery like they do in Iran.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You just want to make them as comfortable as possible. So, you know.
Comfort them with consumerism. It's not that hard in a capitalist society.
Absolutely. As you see, this 18-year-old is in charge because probably his family gave a bunch of resources to the Night's Watch. And they were like, let's just put this kid in charge of one of the raids.
It's like the FBI case, you know, Operation Varsity Blues. Just give money yes. to the institution to get the kid in there.
I know. No questions asked. Just take the money, shut up, and then, you know, hopefully no one finds out.
So the big thing with these three is they come across... So Will goes in to where he originally saw the bodies. Mm-hmm. And they're gone.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh crap.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the beauties of George R. R. Martin's writing, is that when you read that, your stomach just drops. You know, just thinking about it now, my stomach drops, because mm-hmm. it's just like, it's either like, you know, some sicko that comes in and just took all these bodies, but like, how did they take all these bodies in such a speed?
Or yeah, something like, and not make any noise or, you know, attract mm-hmm. anything. Because again, yeah. with all those like corpses, you would think wild animals would start scavenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And Royce was just acting like a fuckboy gaslighter. It's like, are you sure they were dead? It's like, yes, pretty much. With their eyes open, just standing still in the snow. Yes, they were dead. But he was like, so, are you sure?
To Will's credit, once Royce comes into contact and faces the White Walker, Will mm-hmm. says, like, he was not a boy anymore. He was a man of the Night's Watch. So to his mm-hmm. credit, you know, Will concedes that, yeah, he was very brave at the end. But is that bravery or stupidity just from...
That's what I thought. I thought it was stupidity and just, like, bravery that these, you know, young... lordlings, as Garrett says, that they have. He just thought, I'm going to take this completely weird thing that I've never seen in my life and I'm going to fight him. And that's where the complete mask falls off and you see that he's just not, you know, I guess, who is an accomplished swordsman against a White Walker, but he doesn't fight for very long, and then his sword just shatters, which I think that his sword is sort of a metaphor for him. It's all like glittering and shiny, and
but is it
on the outside? No, exactly, because it completely
like women's
shatters.
Fashion.
Exactly. Where are the pockets? I am wearing sweatpants right now that don't have any pockets. What the hell?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen something like that?
Yeah. I don't need pockets that much because I like my purses, and I would just I just carry as a woman too much stuff to or even if I had pockets that would be relevant. But yeah, like women's fashion, just totally ornate. And you know, my husband was like, there's several instances where we go out and it's like, "Oh, I can't walk anymore in my heels." And he's like, "Why don't they design heels shoes that are comfortable?" And I'm like, "Cuz it's men designing these shoes that are only thinking about the male gaze and not my comfort."
Absolutely. But did you know that heels were actually designed for men to look taller?
This is true. Yeah, in the 18th century, they did wear heels and stockings.
And they were like, this is torture. Let's just give it to the women because they haven't been tortured enough.
Yeah. So Royce dies, obviously. Will starts running. And ultimately, it's implied that Will is choked by Royce, by White Walker Royce.
Yeah, he just goes to I think he stays up in the tree for quite a long time because he climbed up, didn't he, to see like where the hell the corpses came, and then he's witnessed the whole thing. So he stayed there for a little bit, then he came down and he was just like, what the hell has just happened? Looks at Royce and he was just like, well, he is just a little kid at the end of the day. He is just an 18-year-old. And then he just, when he goes to stand up, Royce has stood up with these blue eyes, these piercing blue eyes, and just chokes him out, which is poor Will.
Yeah.
I liked Will.
Yeah, poor Will, because he had been... So Garrett was the most experienced, like, you know, 20 plus years. Royce had only been there for like half a year, and then Will had been there 4 years.
Yeah. It makes me feel really sad. He just seems like a very quiet... He still seems very young. But very quiet, very, I'll do what you say. Don't bother me, please. Don't talk to me.
Yeah, and it's like, because Will, he wasn't a rapist or a murderer. He was a poacher. Like, that's how he got on the wall.
Out of everyone. Yeah, out of everyone that goes to the wall, I think he's, you know, one of the good ones. But again, it is a theme in this that, you know, the good ones always have to die.
And that, in essence, is the prologue. And we don't hear about what happens to Garrod until we get to Bran's chapter. Yeah, so what did you think of Bran?
So I think it's very curious how we start. We basically start this journey with Bran, because I think through the eyes of a child, I guess we start to experience this new world. So I think that's why it was established, Bran as the first person that we see from his point of view. He's a good establishing point of view to start looking at things. I think that this chapter through Bran sets up a lot of stories and explains a lot of aspects of the chapter, like who the Starks are and why Jon Snow is a bit more different than the rest of his family. And then him going to his first execution is a good jumping off point, establishing the tone of the book as well.
And yeah, so his first execution. So through Bran, we get, of course, Eddard Stark, Robb Stark, Jon Snow, Theon Greyjoy. Theon Greyjoy, still a piece of crap, even early on, kicking the decapitated head.
Yeah, I have it written here, special mention to Theon Greyjoy. Like, he's older than Robin John. I think he's 19, while Robin John is 14. But he behaves younger. He's impulsive and, like, very simple-minded. Like you said, kicking Garrett's head, calling the dire wolf a freak, and, like, he wanted to kill the pup. It's like, get a grip of yourself. Just, like, calm down.
And I'm just thinking, you know, he's 19, so Ned Stark has indulged this. And again, I'm thinking a lot about, you know, certain characters and, you know, people in authority like Mormont or Stark. And I'm like, why is this being indulged? And I think maybe in Theon's position, I think Ned may feel, I don't know if guilty is the right term, but just, you know, has sympathy for Theon's position that ultimately he's a hostage. And
yeah.
It's kind of, you know, kind of settled with himself to not discipline unless he does something really, really bad, but just let him be a typical young, you know, idiot.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's exactly what I thought. I thought that, you know, I think that he thought we've taken away so much from him as it is. Let him just be who he is. Which not that good, because if he got raised with John and Rob and Bran, you know, Sansa and Arya, he would have been a more sensible young man. But he's still a little shit.
The biggest little shit.
Oh yeah, 100%.
So yeah, I think my memory from the show clouded my memory with the book, because in the show, the person who is executed is the younger guy, so it's like Will. Mm-hmm. But in the book, it's Garrett is the one who made it past the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they don't show a lot of what was said. You know, what Garrett said to try and convince them what was happening. They didn't show anything. They were just, oh, this guy is probably just a wildling, and he looks raggedy, and he's just here to, you know, reap and rape, so let's just kill him.
Yeah, it's Ned makes a point later on, like, this wasn't some green boy that was easily scared. This was like a really seasoned member of the Night's Watch. But yeah, I don't know if maybe his age played into the, oh, he's just going crazy, or I don't know. It's Ned is a little bit contradictory in terms of, you know, him trying to digest this new information. Like, again, probably what we didn't see was said, but what was undoubtedly he heard what was said from Garrett, and then getting the direwolf and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think that that Ned takes his responsibilities very seriously. That's what I got from, you know, these two chapters that he's present in. He's very serious. You know, there's a part of him that it feels like he doesn't want to do it, but he does it. Mm-hmm. You know, he does it anyway, because he has to.
And so we get, basically, in a nutshell, we get, you know, Ned Stark's character with, he's talking to Bran, is like, do you know why I had to do it? And his famous line of the one that passes the sentence should swing the sword. And it's one of the very iconic quotes of Ned Stark in Game of Thrones. And I found myself appreciating it a lot more because, you know, in my job, I'm dealing with certain situations where people on top are making decisions that they don't have to feel the consequences for. So I find that admirable, that, you know, I'm not going to pass over this yucky job because it's unpleasant and I have the authority to pass it on. Like, I have to, like, face the reality of what my political or otherwise decisions have on the world.
Yeah, exactly. It says, if you would take a man's life, you owe it to him to look into his eyes and hear his final words, which shows, like, how much of a noble person he is, even though he's carrying out a very unpleasant job that is not going to be seen very favorably to other people, even though, you know, he might feel sorry for whoever it is that, you know, he has to sentence, but he's doing his duty. He's very noble, but he's like, you know, this is unpleasant, but I will do it.
Yeah, and I really like, again, Ned as a being very Socratic with Bran, and it's just, you know, because Bran's saying, Rob says the man died bravely, but John said he was afraid. And mm-hmm. Ned's like, but what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Bran says, can a man still be brave if he's afraid? I think what is true,
yeah, that is
what
the Ned only time, yeah.
Yeah, that a man can be brave. That is true if you think about all the things that, you know, you do, obviously not killing someone and not, you know, running away from crazy, scary monsters. But, you know, every time that you get scared are the times that you have to do the bravest things. So for me, for example, with speaking in public, if I have to speak in public, I get like so scared. But then it actually turns out to be one of the best things that I actually do. So, you know, he's very wise. It's curious that he has lived for 30, he's like 35, and I don't know any 35-year-olds that is that wise.
Indeed, yeah. And Sean Bean playing him, because what was he, like 50?
yeah. I do have issues with casting and TV shows and films, but let's not get me started on that, because...
Oh, the age stuff, yeah, like, they're, like... one of the earlier James Bonds, Roger Moore, like it got mm-hmm. to a point where he himself was creeped out that he was supposed, like his love interest, the Bond girls were like, you know, the age of his daughters.
That's disgusting. That is absolutely disgusting. Oh, yeah, it is very creeped out. I'm glad that he realizes that,
Yeah. And then we get the big symbolism of, you know, the dead direwolf.
Mm-hmm. This is a huge foreshadowing. Like, this chapter has like two huge foreshadowings. Like, the first one is the dead direwolf, and I guess the other one is Theon Greyjoy, where he was just like so eager to kill the pup that was in Bran's arms mm-hmm. that I was just like, oh, this little shit. He likes to jump to conclusions very quickly. The direwolf was killed by an antler.
And I like this symbolism because, you know, at a very, you know, obviously it's, you know, everyone's talked about how this is symbolism of the sort of, you know, how Stark is screwed over by mm-hmm. the Baratheons. But, you know, yeah. a lot of people would make the case that wasn't so much the Baratheons as it was, you know, the Lannisters, a.k.a. Cersei and things like that. But mm-hmm. I like the idea of honing in on that maybe Robert wasn't the, like, schemer, but mm-hmm. he let certain things happen. He indulged Cersei, and that sort of conflict that eventually arises between Cersei and Ned and Catelyn and Tyrion. So yeah. I like the idea of, like, holding people accountable. It's like, this is your queen. You technically have the authority to overrule mm-hmm. her, but you just don't want to deal with it. So I'm all for holding Robert Baratheon accountable, and this symbolism of, yeah, that it's the Lannisters being, you know, shitty mm-hmm. instigators, but also Robert is complicit in that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, I think Robert was the catalysis, like you said, for all the events to happen, for whatever happened. It wouldn't have been possible if Robert didn't demand that Ned would go down and be the Hand. And it wouldn't have happened if Ned outright refused and said absolutely not. So I think, yeah, I think there is, yeah, there is a blame on Robert, but there is also a blame on Ned. I think that he does a lot of things that he doesn't want to do because of Robert, because mm-hmm. not just because Robert is the king, but because he is his friend.
Yeah. And so we get the direwolf pups. And again, I thought it was so cute, you know, that, you know, they convince Ned to let them keep the pups. And Bran is so cute. He has his direwolf snuggled in his coat on his horse, on his little pony. And it's like adorable.
I know. It's so precious. It's so precious. I have it, like, you know, in my mind, just this like newborn babies that are just so helpless. And it like, I think there was a bit where this is like the pup licked his chin, mm-hmm. as well. It's so cute. But what I found it, like, there's a huge symbolism here that the dead direwolf was described as huge by Bran. Well, mm-hmm. with Bran's point of view. And then also Bran described his dad as a giant on a horse, you know, that he had to look up when his dad asked him, mm-hmm. you know, about the execution. So I thought it was a huge symbolism there.
Yeah, no, this is true, because not just House Stark, but specifically Ned Stark. And mm-hmm. it just shows the elk's or the stag's carcass is not there. It's just the antler, mm-hmm. whereas in the show, the whole carcass is there and we see that it's dead. Yeah. So,
yeah,
like in that way, you can interpret that both Robert and Ned die, whereas in the, we technically didn't know if that stag survived in the book or not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly. And honestly, again, because I'm also doing my Harry Potter podcast, The Rambling Raven Puffs. Go check that out, listeners, as well. Mm-hmm. The symbolism, of course, with the stag as prongs mm-hmm. and the wolf as Mooney.
Yeah, yeah. It's it that they're just like, it goes hand in hand, right? These two symbols.
Yeah. Yeah, these two symbols, and I kept telling them, like, how is that applied to, you know, the Harry Potter symbolism of these two specific animals and the characters associated with them? Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but think that a lot of, you know, as much as I adore Remus Lupin as a character, you know, his biggest flaw is that he didn't stand up to his buddies when they were being stupid and bullying people. And so mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, the wolf getting impaled by the antler is symbolic of James's influence when he was a little shithead and did not the best things, and Remus didn't do anything because he was so desperate, because these were the few people in the world who accepted him, who knew his secret. So yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I think that it does come to also the point, you know, from James and Lupin, and also Ned and Robert Baratheon. It's like, you know, Ned doesn't exactly want to do what Robert does. There's a very massive reluctance, but he still does it. Mm-hmm. Just like Lupin, just like, okay, I will just follow that.
Yeah, and hopefully at a later date in our bonus episodes on Patreon, we will do a comparison of Ned Stark and Remus Lupin.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so they keep them. And my biggest thing that I actually forgot about was, you know, of course, Jon at the last moment discovers the last direwolf pup. And he's considered the runt because he's obviously the smallest. Mm-hmm. But unlike the other direwolf pups, this one's eyes, ghost eyes, are open.
Yeah.
So yeah. What does that say, that the bastard runty one, it has his eyes open while all the others are closed?
So I thought that, first of all, the color of the pup is just like white, like Targaryen hair. Okay.
Ooh.
Let's just leave that there. But also I think that, Ghost is very much... You can see how these animals are so closely bonded already to their owners. And I thought that, the ghost with his eyes already open, it links to Jon Snow, who has been very alert and perceptive through this whole chapter. Like, you know, when he and Rob were talking about Garrett, and Rob was like, oh yeah, he died very bravely. And Jon was like, no, it was not courage. This one was dead of fear. And then, you know, John also noticing the amount of pups, then noticing his dire wolf. And then it also signifies, you know, that he's wise beyond his ears, because, like, how did the other pups, like, you know, they have their eyes closed, but Ghost has already just matured enough to, like, have his eyes open. And John is also very mature for his age, like, how he accepts that he's not a legitimate child, how he knows that, you know, he's just not part of that group of people. So I think that Ghost it really mirrors John and, like, his resilience.
Mm-hmm. This is true. And thus concludes, you know, Bran's chapter. And then we move on to our third chapter, Catelyn. There are a lot of people who criticize the audiobook of Game of Thrones and Roy Dotrice and his performance because apparently he will like be totally random and inconsistent with pronouncing these names. But quite honestly, like, I'm listening to the audiobook. I have it from Libby. And, like, I don't, when I'm listening to it, I don't register him using different names or being annoying in that way. And I'm thinking, and I'm usually, I won't just accept any audiobook. Like, there are books I like that I tried the audiobook and I'm like, oh no, I don't like this. And so I'm secretly wondering if this is what I'm checking out from the digital library. Is did they remaster it and redo it so that the names are consistent? And because I don't understand the huge criticism, so maybe that's what they did, but I don't know. But Catelyn, like, he would go all over the place, apparently, according to some.
Well, maybe people complained too much and then got him back to re-record. You never know. People are crazy.
Yeah. But anyway, we move on to Catelyn. First sentence, Catelyn has never liked this Godswood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let me just lay down here. I hate Catelyn with a passion.
So I don't know if I hate her with a burning passion, but from seeing her portrayal on the TV show and reading what goes on in her head sometimes, I also significantly dislike book Catelyn.
Yeah. Yeah, I my notes regards to her point of view might be quite skewed, let's say.
Scathing.
But yeah, that bit where she says Catelyn has never liked this Godswood, it just feels to me like she never really accepted.
Yeah, so Catelyn, I was just really surprised that she's been in the North for 20 years and she still kind of has this sort of, I guess it's not snobbery, but still lack of comfort around certain elements of, you know, the environment in which she's been living.
Yeah, she behaves a lot like a summer child, very like a southerner, you know. Yeah, it's just this issue with, yeah, she never liked this Godswood. It just doesn't convey, this whole chapter doesn't convey that she has never fully accepted where she lives, and the fact that she's also a Stark by marriage. She hasn't really adapted to that, you know, which says it was dark. It was a dark and primal place to describe the Godswoods, and that it grows around a gloomy castle. It's like, that's your home, you know?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was describing the Godswood in Riverrun as being a garden bright and airy with tall redwoods. And that just made me think of the Redwoods National Park in California, one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm. I've never visited, but I hope to one day.
It is beautiful because the trunks are like so huge in diameter and like they're probably thousands of years old.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you see some behaviors of hers that mirrors Sansa? Just sort of like a little spoiled.
Yes, I can understand why Sansa is the way she is based on Catelyn. And, you know, and the fact that, you know, and Catelyn has done his, in my opinion, has done his disservice to Sansa because Sansa is so susceptible to the glittering lights of the South is because that's you know, Catelyn in her own, you know, missing of her home has romanticized the South in a way to her. That makes Sansa so susceptible to negative influence.
Yeah, yeah. She very much in this chapter, she authorizes the North and these people who, I guess, because it is, you know, the first point of view that we see is Bran and the Starks, we start sympathizing with them. So in comes this woman who is just like, oh yeah, the South is much better and the South is prettier and is this and is that. And but then these God's words are very weird. And she says as well about Ned, like his own gods were the old ones. Like his own gods were the old ones. And it's just like, get a grip, grow up.
And would it have been, like, would she have been this way had she married Brandon Stark?
I think so. Because she would still have to go up to the North.
Yeah,
I just
like,
think she's very...
Yeah, I'm just wondering if how much of this is legitimately about the environment itself or whether it's from, even though it was arranged marriage, like I was looking forward to marrying Brandon and then I get stuck with Ned. And just always having that sort of barrier that I didn't get exactly what I wanted, and therefore I'm not gonna like see the good things in the North.
Maybe that might be part of it. But I think that she genuinely loves him. I think she's
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. But maybe that's why she hasn't fully accepted, you know, yeah, her like, place.
Yeah, because yeah, even if she accepts Ned as a person, can that disappointment fully extend to, you know, her lightening up about the North?
Yeah, exactly. I just found her very unpleasant and spoiled in that first section.
Yep. So she is going to the Godswood and Ned is there cleaning off his sword, iced like a badass.
His huge sword.
Yeah, his really big sword. And she was describing the Godswood as like in the south, or like in the River Run where she was, they had a Godswood, but there was no heart tree. And I'm thinking, what is the definition of a Godswood if it doesn't have one of those like iconic heart trees?
Yeah, they said that they were cut off, wasn't it? It was just a place that they didn't worship, that they just left the worship for the Sept. So I guess their Godswoods were more sparse and they're just more recreational instead of spiritual, like it is like, for the North.
Yeah, I read in one of my, you know, I have a few extra, like, you know, books about history of, you know, Westeros and stuff. The Heart Tree, you know, at Casterly Rock is underground and sounds really dope, and I would wish I could see that one.
Yes, it would have been amazing to be able to see that. Oh my god. Hopefully in the new,
House show of the Dragon coming out, or whatever.
Yeah, they'll show, but I don't know. Yeah, because it wouldn't be the Lannisters' house just yet. The Lannisters' bit of land just yet.
And so we get Catelyn coming into the Godswood and has to break the news to Ned. And it's like, oh, I'm so sorry. Jon Arryn has died.
Yeah, and Ned just, he's just very sad. And then we find out, I think Catelyn's chapter serves a lot to make connections about setting up a lot of the world and the connection. So, you know, we discover more of Ned's character, how he is, but also the relationships that he has with Jon Arryn and Robert Baratheon. So he was ward of Jon Arryn when he was younger with Robert Baratheon. And then Jon Arryn was one of the first people who rose up when Aerys Targaryen said that they demanded their heads. He was like, absolutely not.
Yeah, because otherwise, again, the North is pretty secluded and out there. There wouldn't have been any other way for the Starks to have such a strong connection to the Baratheons, who are way down south in the Stormlands.
Yeah. That's where they became friends. That's where they learned to fight. Jon Arryn was the link that tied them both together. And then obviously they became, like Catelyn said, they became brothers 15 years ago when they both married Catelyn and
the Tully sisters. Liza.
Yes, the Tully sisters.
Yeah, so what I was thinking is, you know, when Ned hears about this, he's like, he's not just feeling bad for himself, again, showing that he's a good guy. He feels bad for, you know, his sister-in-law, Lysa. And she's like, and at once Ned is like, you know, go to Lysa, take the children, you know, go cheer her up. And I just couldn't help but thinking, what would have that been like had Catelyn gone to the Eyrie with some of the Starks and like keeping up with the Tully sisters?
I know, right? It would have been insane. Knowing how neurotic his sister, her sister is, it would just be just a very odd situation, because I think, like, well, you know, that Arya would probably like just be wrecking shit up and like trying to maybe like climb down the moon door.
Because I think at this point Arya and Bran would be the closest in age to their cousin, which is Robin.
Yeah, so Robin is the same age as Bran, and I think Arya is
like 2 years older.
yeah, mm-hmm. or two, yeah, from Bran. So like, I think that she would just, because she would see how much of a wet wipe Robin is, and would just be like, oh, screw this kid, and would just like run around while I think Bran would follow her. And
honestly, with Bran, before his accident, him climbing, I think he would have really liked the Eyrie despite everything.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, but it would be curious to see how everything would have turned out. Obviously, it wouldn't be, Bran wouldn't have been thrown. We'll find out a bit later on that,
yeah,
Lysa just plotted that incident. Oh, yeah. So it would eventually come around, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And Catelyn's like, you know, that would be great, taking the kids going to the Eyrie, but we don't have time for that shit because Robert is coming. Guess who's coming to dinner?
Dun, dun, dun. The whole king and his whole court.
And an entourage.
Yeah. And no wonder she's just like, how are we going to feed everyone? Because fucking hell. It's like him, his like wife, the wife's brothers.
Family.
Yeah. Like the cousins, whatever. Everyone.
The children, 100, you know, knights to protect them all. And
yeah.
It's a whole circus, and I sometimes do daydream about a fan fiction where if there was another Lannister sister who was slightly nicer, like Tyrion, and how would that go on in Winterfell? But yeah, but that's just being a crazy nerd, and I will never write it because I will respect J.R.R. Martin's dislike for fan fiction.
Yeah, I wouldn't, just because I'm not that creative, but anyway.
And yeah, so they're like, like they don't talk about it too much yet, like,
yeah,
about, you know, the deeper implications, like why would he bring his whole court there. At first just like, oh yay Robert's coming, and maybe you just feel sad that John Arryn died and all those things.
Yeah,
like Ned isn't thinking too much ahead, and not even Catelyn is specifically thinking that far ahead, but she just has a slight inclination that if his whole court is coming, that means something. I don't know what it means, but it means something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's also the fact that she is a bit she's a bit scared because she overheard the people talking about the bad omen that it is that they found the dire wolf with the antler stuck to his throat. So he is, you know, she is very much scared of what Robert coming up might cause.
And it's just interesting that she has that sort of superstition and not so much Ned yet, because again, in doing this whole contrast between the North and the South, a lot, you know, a big component of that is religious. And so the idea of the superstition and taking those sort of like spiritual things seriously, that's all about like the old gods and that sort of philosophy. But she's a Southerner follower of the Seven that has less emphasis on that. So it's interesting that she's making that leap and not so much Ned.
Yeah, maybe she has been a bit, you know, living there for God knows how many years. She has been susceptible to taking on those superstitions. What I found it curious as well is that in this chapter, we also get a taste of who the Lannisters are just by Ned's reaction towards them.
Ah, yes. Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is my absolute last note of my notes is, again, we basically get the idea that, you know, Ned's opinion of the Lannisters is not very high because he perceives them as only joining Robert's rebellion when it became very apparent that Robert was going to win. And so I have my note here is Gryffindor versus Slytherin ideals.
Yes.
And again, the Lannisters are not the only ones who did that. Like, when the Targaryens first conquered, basically the Tyrells did the same thing, realized, okay, the Targaryens are gonna win, you know, we're just gonna, you know, capitulate to them. And by doing so, they usurped the Gardener Kings and became Lord Paramount of the Reach, rather than maybe families closer to the original Gardener Kings, like House Florent and other things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But yeah, like in this world, what is the age-old question is, what is the balance of honor and self-preservation?
I think it's very difficult when it comes to the Starks, especially. Well, especially Ned, I think. Mm-hmm. He's very much about self-preservation, but when it comes to Robert, it's a whole other situation. You know, mm-hmm. he even with Catelyn, he's very much reserved towards her. You know, from when she comes into the woods and she sees him, and he's just like, you know, where are the kids? And he's just very closed off from her. Mm-hmm. He's very mysterious. You know, no one ever knows. But when it comes to Robert, he's very much, yeah, whatever, I will do whatever you need me to do. Mm-hmm. And I guess in this world, well, when it comes to Ned specifically, I think he should have stuck to self-preservation.
Well, of course. But yeah, just very interesting to think about. And, you know, that concludes Catelyn's chapter. Shall we move on into our history lessons?
Let's do it.
So my history lesson that I came across, the biggest thing that came to me is, of course, the contrast between the seven and the old gods, which, of course, mm-hmm. is a parallel to Christianity versus paganism.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that, and it's kind of interesting because the seven, again, came with the first men, as I understand. So, like, again, it the idea that paganism, like in England and, you know, with the Celts and everything, was the original indigenous, you know, spirituality of that land, mm-hmm. and that Christianity was imported from the Middle East, and likewise, the Seven was imported into Westeros. And what's, mm-hmm. and it's interesting that that was the past, and now, and Christianity now is the sort of defining, one of the defining sociological characteristics of the Western world. Mm-hmm. Even though it was originally in the Middle East, and then, and now, so Christianity defines the West, and now there's the other, the big scary, you know, influence, you know, Islam from the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I think, you know, later down the line, I feel like that parallels, you know, the Lord of Light religion now, like taking that sort of same position as Islam as creeping into Westeros, where the Seven has been established.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was my two cents. And it was just interesting because I'm not a huge scholar, of course, on various sects of Christianity, but very much the Seven highlights, I think, you know, various tenets of Catholicism in yeah. terms of like incest and like the churches, you know, and mm-hmm. the temples and things like that, which is just funny because a lot of other sects of Christianity criticize Catholicism of those sort of theatrics as stemming from paganism.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we can just think of maybe there are some of these things that were in the, you know, how people used to worship the old gods, and they incorporated them in for like the political survival of the new religion of the Seven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. The Seven also has the correlation that they have is the you know, the faces, the seven
with the Trinity, yeah, of course,
with the Trinity, yeah, in you know, having a person who leads mass, I guess, because you do have the scepter, is that the name of the person,
the sept,
yeah,
oh, wait, no, or the high septon, excuse me,
yeah, the high septon. So you have, you know, you go to an actual place to worship, just like Christianity.
Mm-hmm. What was your history lesson?
So my history lesson is the contrast of the wildlings and the Scots in the 12th century. So that's where Scotland is very much on my mind because I will be going to Scotland soon, and I'm very excited.
Like Edinburgh or where?
So I'm going to Edinburgh, Dundee, and Glasgow. Hi. Yeah, so I'm very excited. I'm going to see if I can stop by Hadrian's Wall as well, mm-hmm. So I can see the actual wall that was based on the wall.
Yeah,
and I've got very much Scotland in my mind. So I thought it would be a treat to talk about the wildlings and how they were based on the Scots back in the
day. Down to the red hair.
Down to the red hair, exactly like that. So much so that, you know, back in the 12th century, between the 9th century and the 12th century, the Scots had different tribes who spoke various languages, which is what the wildlings are also described as later on
mm-hmm.
in the series. And the Scots were seen as savages by mm-hmm. the English, and especially by the Northerners, who had to deal with, you know, a lot of raids and reaping.
Just natural close contact with them.
Yeah, exactly. So they were just a menace to them. So a lot of what they are being described in Bran's chapter is also the same as how they are described by this Northern English chronicler called Richard Hexham.
Mm-hmm.
So Bran described the wildlings in the first bit of his chapter, from what Old Nan told mm-hmm. him. They said that they were cruel men, slavers and slayers and thieves. They consorted with giants and ghouls, stole girl children in the dead of night, and drank blood from polished horns. Their women laid with the others in the long night to sire terrible half-human children. And then Richard Hexham described the Scottish sort of in the same way, mm-hmm. but a little bit more wordy. So he said, by the sword's edge or the spear's point, they slaughtered the sick in their beds, women who were pregnant or in labor, babies in their cradles or at their mother's breast, and sometimes they killed the mothers too. They slaughtered worn-out old men, feeble old women. They killed husbands in front of their wives. Then they carried off their plunder, and the women, both widows and maidens, stripped, bound, and roped together, they drove them off, goading them with spears on the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, a very much, mm-hmm. you know, not good, not a great way to view them. But because they had tribes, they mm-hmm. were they had a different range of people that, mm-hmm. You know, that they couldn't just fit into one. It's just one type of people that they saw. There were even there were something that made me chuckle when I read that. They were this group that would fight naked, and then they startled Englishmen when they went to like meet them to fight them, and they startled these Englishmen because they were all naked fighting naked. And it's just it was so hilarious just to like think in my head how hilarious it was. It's like in 1138. But so this divide mm-hmm. was not only between the Scots and the English, but also the Highland Scots and the English-speaking Scots. So the Highland Scots thought that, you know, or they were also known as the Lowlanders. So the Highlanders.
Yeah, Lowlanders, well, it's kind of like, you know, this sort of, you know, mixed group with Ireland, the Anglo-Irish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, there's a lot in, you know, my specialty in academia was like Middle Eastern studies. And of course, mm-hmm. there are people like Bernard Lewis and others who perpetuate the sort of clash of civilizations theory that, of course, Western Christendom is going to have significant problems with, you know, the Islamic world, because they're just coming from totally substantially different cultures and worldviews and ways of thinking. And to a certain extent, yes, but at the same time, like, I think of this sort of history and it's like the English couldn't get along with the Irish or the Scots.
Yeah, exactly. Anyone that they tried, anyone that was near them, remotely near, they wanted to take over, they wanted to like colonize and it's just like, oh yeah, make them more civilized. And it's just like, just respect other people's cultures, which is not very a strong point of the English back then, somewhat not now either.
Alrighty then, and thank you so much for that history lesson. Now we shall transition to our friendship lessons. So my friendship lesson actually, of all people, comes from Catelyn.
Oh, okay.
My friendship lesson is be considerate of your friend's state of mind and surrounding when delivering bad news.
Right, yeah.
So for as much as we were bitching that Catelyn hasn't really adjusted all that well to life in the North and still sees herself as an outsider, she still took it upon herself to go to the Godswood and go to a place where she knows Ned feels the most comfortable and in his element, even though it's totally not that. She doesn't feel that way for the Godswood. But she still, she could have just waited till he came home and like told him at the castle. But she took it upon herself to go out to the Godswood. And of course, you know, sometimes you cannot control certain things. Like if it's an emergency, yeah, you gotta just tell them whenever. But if things like this, that something has happened and there's nothing you can do to change it, like a death, like, you know, she goes out of her way to break the news gently.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, yeah, thinking about it the way that you put it, that is a way to carry yourself, to put yourself out there, to, you know, get out of your comfort zone, be a friend, be a shoulder. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. What was your friendship lesson?
So my friendship lesson comes from my fave, Jon Snow. Jon Snow will always be my fave, just because he's, you know, he's always so on the outside and yeah. But look out for your friends and make sure that they are prepared. So like he did with Bran when they went to watch the execution and he knew it was, you know, the first time that Bran was there and he knew that Bran wouldn't want to be embarrassed, so he said, you know, make sure you don't look away and make sure you have a stronghold on your pony. He was also on his side, you know, just, you know, highlighting, oh, you got 5 dire pups and they are meant to be, you know, they're meant to be for your children, you know, just like putting himself below just so his family could have that. Yeah, it's very noble. So it's nobility. And make sure that you go out of your way to for your friends.
Yeah. Wonderful. I'm sure this will be one of many friendship lessons from Jon Snow.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And thus concludes the very first episode of Podcaster's Landing. Tune in next time where the chapters we will cover 4, 5, and 6 will be Daenerys, Eddard, and John. Catch you guys later, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Podcaster's Landing. The music to our intro is copyrighted by Persian German composer Ramin Djawadi. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophia Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMareStudios. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.